Now, we're working through the book of Deuteronomy, and very different style of writing to Song of Solomon that we've just finished. Things are it's a bit more plain speaking. Some people like that. Some people, more inclined towards other things. But anyway, I'm just rambling. Let's get into it. So Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 1. In chapter 1, of course, the Israelites had come to the point where they were ready to cross over into the promised land. There was a bit of a... Ernest was talking this morning about... what are they called? Memorials. And that sort of thing. And it's kind of what's happening in this first part of the book of Deuteronomy is before the people cross over, Moses is reminding them of things that have happened. Now, many of them were part of that experience. And so it's not like they needed to hear the story so they knew what happened. Remember that the Israelites have been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. And it was those that were of fighting age when they first left Egypt that weren't allowed to go into the promised land. So many of those who were with them, they either were children when the events happened that prevented them from going into the promised land, or if they were born along the way, they would have been told the stories and they experienced stuff as well, if you sort of read in Exodus and Numbers. So, it's not like they're coming from a place of ignorance. But Moses said, let's remember what's happened. Let's remember that we did come up out of Egypt and we got to Kadesh Barnea. And I said, okay, you can go in, but the people didn't trust in God that he could bring them into the promised land because there were giants there and they were afraid. And they thought God had brought them out to kill them. And God says, well, you've completely misread the situation. And because of that, you're not able to go in and possess the land. Once you've all passed away, then your children will be the ones who take possession. So they came to that point, and so they were told to go back into the wilderness. And verse 1 of chapter 2 says, then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea, which is back where they'd come from, as the Lord told me. And for many days we travelled around Mount Seir, which is Mount Sinai. Then the Lord said to me, you have been travelling around this mountain country long enough. Turn northward and command the people, you are about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the people of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. So be very careful. Do not contend with them, for I will not give you any of their land. No, not so much as for the sole of the foot to tread on, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. You shall purchase food from them with money that you may eat, and you shall also buy water from them with money that you may drink. For the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He knows you're going through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you, you have lacked nothing. So he went on away from our brothers, the people of Esau, who lived in Seir, away from the Araba road, from Elath to Ezion Geba. All right. So the Israelites have been wandering for 38 years in the wilderness. The Lord's been disciplining them. And what he's been doing in that discipline is teaching them to become a nation, understanding that they had been slaves in Egypt for 400 years. And what that meant was that they had a slave culture, that they thought as slaves do. And, you know, when you really think about it, what an incredible thing God did was to take people who were who had never governed themselves for the past 400 years and brought them out to make them into a nation. And it takes time to shift culture. Like we tend to think the way that we think, and we don't like to change the way we think. And the reason we don't like to change the way we think is because if we change one thing, we don't like to admit it to ourselves, but it means that we've got to change a whole heap of things about what we've thought about other things. And it's kind of like you're thinking, oh, I'm going to have to go back and redig my foundations and start again. And, you know, it just appeared like there was just this one thing, don't be slaves anymore and you can go out. But then they're like, well, how do we live? What does it mean? What do we do? And there's also a mindset that comes with being independent. It says in Proverbs that there are, I'm trying to think of the exact proverb, but it says there are three things that the earth groans under and four that, you know, it struggles with, something like that. Someone will find it, but Gail's already looking for me. But one of them is a pauper that becomes a king, or a pauper that becomes a prince, something like that. And the reason it's hard for the world is because if we have a mindset of, in this instance, being poor and sort of just being able to get by, how do you become a king from that position and be responsible for administering benefits to others when you've only been focused on yourself? And so there's a significant mindset change that happens with that. I can't believe I'm even going to talk about this, but there's been a lot in the media about, you know, the royal family lately. Anyway, I don't want to, and I don't even like to talk about it, but it's an illustration of the point that I'm making. When you look at Queen Elizabeth II's reign, she was someone who understood what it was to be a sovereign. And she was trained from a fairly young age, and she wasn't expecting to be the sovereign until she was sort of into her 12 years old or something, was she? Yeah, something like that, when her dad became king. Or was it maybe a bit younger than that? Who knows? I don't know. Anyway, she was a young child. And suddenly she was next in line for the throne. And so she was schooled in the constitution. She was taught how to rule. Obviously there were some other influences there. She had a strong Christian conviction. And it meant that she understood the service that's required to be a good sovereign. And not only that, but she'd grown up in the tradition of the place where she understood the customs and the importance of the customs and why things were done that way and the stability that those things bring to the Westminster system of government. And when people come in as, you know, certain people did recently, and they just marry into a family like that and they haven't been brought up, they've got no cultural background to lean on to understand the significance of what's really going on. And so they look at things and make value judgments based on the values of being just of their previous world. That's right, yeah. And there's no appreciation it's not just that there's no appreciation, but there's also not a willingness to come to terms with and understand why things happen the way they do. And they're just sort of dismissed as being old school and out of date and so on. But these are actually the things that give stability to our government and to our culture. And so it's a very dangerous game to get caught up in the mindset that is quick to accuse our leaders. Because of our ignorance and our lack of appreciation of why things happen the way that they do. I've been rambling now. But this is the issue that the Israelites were dealing with. So they've been slaves in Egypt. They've been oppressed. They've been, you know, all those things. And all that they wanted was freedom. And now they've got their freedom. What do? It's like, how do I administer this? And when they came to the promised land the first time, they still had a slave mindset. They weren't warriors. They were worriers. They sort of were thinking, how's this going to happen? There's giants in the land. We don't know how to fight. We've just come from slavery. We've wandered around Mount Sinai for a couple of years, and now we're here in Kadesh Barnea, and we're ready to go in and take on the Anakites, who were giants, like big guys. They're, you know, 9 feet tall, and spears that were sort of massive, big beds that are recorded, 9 feet long or whatever, and huge. So they couldn't do it. They just couldn't make the transition. Except for Caleb and Joshua. They trusted God. And they thought, well, look, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but we know we can trust God. And so God said, well, because of their faith, they are able to enter the promised land. The rest didn't have faith, and so they weren't able to partake of the grace of God in that circumstance. So all of those people have passed on, and they're ready to enter in, and God's bringing them back to the promised land, but they've got to go through the land that the Edomites, the descendants of Esau, have been given as a possession. Now, God gave that land to the Edomites, and so the Israelites weren't going to get any because God had given it to Edom, to Esau. Now, what we find when we read in Deuteronomy is that God says, look, I want you to pass through this land, pay for what you eat, pay for what you drink, because I've blessed you so that you're going to be able to do that. God had provided for Israel to be able to sustain themselves and to pay their way. Now, when we read in Numbers 20 and verse 14 to 21, I probably won't go there, but you can read it yourself. What actually happened was when the Israelites went into the land of Esau and said, look, can we please pass through? We won't take anything unless we pay for it. We won't drink anything unless we pay for it. And the Edomites said, no, you can't. So Israel's got a problem. Do they contend with Esau? Or do they leave it with God? Which is the same situation that Jacob had with Esau. Is he going to contend with Esau, or is he going to leave it with God? Because the stuff from the past was still coming up. It was still raising its head. You know, the Edomites were afraid and jealous of the Israelites. And so they wouldn't let them pass through. So the Israelites decided that they would actually head north and go around the land of the Edomites. And that was the solution to that one. They said, we're not going to fight this fight because God's not going to be with us if we try, because this land belongs to Edom. In the process, Edom missed out on the blessing because the Israelites were going to pay for everything as they went through. But their stubborn hearts and their fear meant that they said, no, we don't want anything to do with you. You can go around. And they missed out on all of that benefit that would have come economically to them if they'd allowed the Israelites to come in and stay, you know, pay your way. Yeah, that's, you know, do the, yeah, anyway. So they went through there. Let's go to verse 8 of chapter 2. It says, and we turned and went in the direction of the wilderness of Moab. And the Lord said to me, do not harass Moab or contend with them in battle, for I will not give any of their land, give you any of their land for a possession, because I've given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession. So the Moabites were descendants of Lot. As you know, Abraham and Lot, you know the story. Lot was Abraham's nephew. He left Ur of the Chaldeans with Abraham to go to Canaan and to possess some of the land. And God blessed them. They became too numerous, and so Abraham said to Lot, "Look, your livestock and my livestock are competing for resources. Our shepherds are starting to come to blows and all that sort of thing. So you choose which way you want to go, and I'll go the other way. And, you know, God bless you. We're going to have to part company, but on good terms." And so Lot chose the plains of Sodom and Gomorrah, and the story goes on. But God blessed Lot and gave him an inheritance. So the Israelites weren't to touch that inheritance either, because God had given it to them. So they went through there. And it says in brackets that the Emim formerly lived there, a people great and many, as tall as the Anakim, or the Anakites. Like the Anakim, they are also counted as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim. The Horites also lived in Seir formerly, but the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them before them and settled in their place, as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. Now, rise up and go over the brook Zered. So we went over the brook Zered, and the time for the leaving, time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the brook Zered was 38 years, until the entire generation, that is the men of war who had perished from the camp, as the Lord had sworn to them. For indeed the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from the camp until they had perished. So a bit going on here, one of the things is that we get this commentary saying that as they go to the Moabite land, there's a reminder for the Israelites that the Anakites were in the Moabite land, and the Moabites dispossessed them, as an encouragement to say, if the Moabites could do it, when you come to the land of Canaan, you're going to be able to do it too. So as you pass through this land, remember that the Anakites used to live here, and they used to live in the land that Esau possessed as well. And so it's not impossible for people to dispossess the Anakites. He's building a testimony of his faithfulness to others as an encouragement for the Israelites, which again was what Ernest was talking about this morning. The other thing is that the reason it took 38 years to get back to that place was because the hand of the Lord was against those who rebelled against his plan to move into the promised land when they first came out. And they weren't able to move on until they were dispossessed. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1, it says, "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." So Paul's pretty clear to the Corinthians that as we're reading through Deuteronomy, as we're reading through Exodus and Numbers and Leviticus as well, and Genesis, that these things aren't just stories. They're there. The reason that they are there is as an example for us. Because we've got to understand, the Israelites weren't given the promised land for them to just go in and take. They had to take it by faith, and God's grace had to be with them to allow that to happen. And so what Paul is saying is, let's consider what happened there, because it's an example for us that we might not desire the same evil things that those that rebelled against him in the wilderness desired. And that the rock that sustained them in the desert is the rock that followed them, and that rock is Christ. Now, last week we talked about the fact that the reason Moses couldn't go into the promised land was because he struck the rock instead of speaking to it. Because the rock was there as a symbol of Christ. And the first time they got water from the rock, Moses was to strike the rock, because Christ was struck to give life for us. But he was only struck once. It was a sacrifice given once and for all. He wasn't struck a second time. But Moses, in his zeal, exuberance, ignorance, disobeyed God, and instead of speaking to the rock, which was what he was told to do the second time, he struck the rock, and in doing so was disobedient to the image of Christ that was presented there. I just want to make the connection that when we're looking at this stuff, it's not just some sort of vague history that sort of sits in the past and is the story of how the Israelites eventually came to the promised land and got the law and all that sort of stuff. But it's there to inform us as Christians. It's highly relevant to us. The stories matter because it speaks truth to us. So it says, "Do not be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for instruction on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with that temptation he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it." Sorry. 1 Corinthians 10, 1 to 13. Because notice that it says that they, I'll just find that in verse 9, it says, "We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did." So we've got to understand that the Old Testament and the New Testament are not two different sets of information. That Christ was there with the Israelites, journeying through the wilderness with them, bringing them into the promised land. And they only entered because of their faith in Christ. That we've, whether we're in the New Testament or the Old Testament, those that were saved were only ever saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. The gospel is the same gospel regardless of which part of the Bible we're reading. Yes. Go on. Yep, that's right. He said, "I didn't come to abolish it, I came to fulfill it." Yeah, he didn't come to remove any aspect of it. He came to say that all of this was actually about me. Everything's fulfilled in him. Yeah. All right, let's go on to verse 16 of Deuteronomy 2. "So as soon as all the men of war had perished and were dead from among the people, the Lord said to me, 'Today you are to cross the border of Moab at Ar. And when you approach the territory of the people of Ammon, do not harass them or contend with them, for I will not give any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot for a possession.'" So Moab and Ammon were descendants of Lot, and that land was set aside. But notice God was anxious, it's interesting the way it's worded, because God was anxious to bring them into the promised land, but he couldn't do it until all of the previous generation had died. And as soon as the last of the previous generation died, then God said, "Right, let's go." He was, because he's true to his word. He's, if he said none of you will enter, then he's waiting for them all to die so that the rest can enter. And again, talking about the Ammonites, it says it's also counted as the land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim, a people great and many, and as tall as the Anakim, But the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place, as he did for the people of Esau who lived in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites before them, and they dispossessed them and settled in their place even to this day. As for the Avim, who lived in villages as far as Gaza and Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and settled in their place. So rise up and set out on your journey and go over the valley of the Arnon. And behold, I have given into your hand Sihon, the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to take possession and contend with him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you on the people who are under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. So the previous generation has died. So then it was time to go in and go through the land of the Ammonites. But same deal. They belong to the descendants of Lot. So pay your way as you go through the Ammonites. But when we come to the land of Sihon, it's going to be different. I'm going to hand him over to you. You're going to take him on. But as you take him on, remember that the Edomites, the Moabites, and the Ammonites all dispossessed the giants when they took their land, because God fought for them. And so now you're going to dispossess the giants because God's going to fight for you, is the context that's behind that. Okay, verse 26. So I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, let me pass through your land. I will go only by the road. I will turn aside neither to the right nor to the left. You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, as the sons of Esau who live in Seir and the Moabites who live in Ar did for me, until I go over the Jordan into the land that the Lord our God is giving to us. But Sihon, the king of Heshbon, would not let them pass by, for the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate, that he might give him into your hand as he is this day. And the Lord said to me, behold, I have begun to give Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to take possession that you may occupy his land. Then Sihon came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Jahaz. And the Lord our God gave him over to us, and we defeated him and his sons and all his people. And we captured all his cities at that time and devoted to destruction every city, men, women, and children. We left no survivors, only the livestock we took as spoil for ourselves, with the plunder of the cities that we captured, from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Ammon, and from the city that is in the valley as far as Gilead. There was not a city too high for us. The Lord our God gave all into our hands. Only the land of the sons of Ammon you did not, only to the land of the sons of Ammon you did not draw near, that is, to all the banks of the river Jabbok and the cities of the hill country, whatever the Lord our God had forbidden us. So, God says, I'm going to give Sihon into your hands, but I want you to go with the same deal that you went to the Moabites, the Ammonites, and the Edomites with, that you offer to pay to go through their land, and that you'll pay for what you eat and pay for what you drink. But I'm going to harden Sihon's heart, which reminds us of what God did to Pharaoh's heart, that he made him obstinate so that he would reject their offer of peace and go to war in order that God could hand that land over to the Israelites. So God had conspired against Sihon because Sihon was occupying land that God hadn't given to him, as opposed to the land that the descendants of Esau and Lot, God had given them that land, and so it was their possession. Sihon was occupying land, but it wasn't his possession in God's eyes. The Israelites were to take possession of that land. So the Israelites went with the olive branch, but Sihon was responsible for provoking the Israelites to war. It wasn't like the Israelites went in to take the land by force. They offered to go through peacefully. Sihon rejected it, and so he wears the consequence of his decision. And it was God who determined that that would be the case. He'd hardened his heart. And so the Amorites were defeated by their unwillingness to accept terms of peace. Amorites as opposed to Ammonites. I know some of the names get a bit tricky. So the Ammonites are Lot's descendants. The Amorites are the guys that were with Sihon. But the thing is, you know, it comes back to this question. Well, who sent the Amorites to destruction? Was it God or was it Sihon? And it's kind of like this thing that, you know, how do people end up in hell? Does God send them there or do they send themselves there? And it says in Romans chapter 3 and verse 15, talking about the wicked, that their feet are swift to shed blood, in their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known, and there's no fear of God in it before their eyes. And Sihon, he didn't know the way of peace. There was only ruin before him. That it was his choice to go to war against the Israelites. It wasn't the Israelites who took him on. And so Sihon is the one who rejected the peace offer that was made, and it led to his destruction. Just like when people go to hell, they reject the offer that Christ has made, and they go to their destruction as a result. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, it says, He, Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. And all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. If indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. See, Christ is, he's the reason for creation. The reason the earth is here is because of Christ. So all of the land on the earth belongs to him, and it's his to give as he determines. So when we read the story of the Israelites possessing the land of Canaan, it's not like, as we sometimes think of it, it's not like a colonization. You know, the whole notion of colonialism is sort of getting a bit of a hammering at the moment anyway. But it's not like they were more powerful than the nations around and they moved in by force to defeat them and take their land from them. The land belongs to God. And God has said, I want you in that place. And the people that are there are going to have to accept that. And if they'll do so peacefully, I've got places for them. But that land is yours. And so it's God's prerogative to do that. Sihon and his followers rejected that offer of peace. And so they were dispossessed of their land. That the way that it says in the fullness, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. It's like Gail was saying before, we were hostile towards God. We were just like Sihon. In fact, we were like the first generation of Israelites who wouldn't go into the promised land because they said, no, God, you've brought us out here to kill us. You're against us. And the hostility in their hearts, maybe from resentment from being slaves for 400 years, who knows what the reasons were. Actually, I can tell you what the reason is. It's called sin. It's our rebellion against God, that we're all hostile towards God. That we all just want to do things our way, and we don't even want to trust God. We want to be self-made people. We want to do it ourselves. We want to decide for ourselves what's right and what's wrong, and we want to accomplish things for ourselves. And God says, no, that's not the way that the universe works. The universe works because of Christ. And when we put our trust in Christ and do things his way, that's the way things work. And if we won't trust that God would bring us into the promised land, that would bring us into his household, bring us to heaven, if you like, then we're like the generation that rebelled against God and followed after idols because they didn't believe God was strong enough to bring him into that place. But he is. Because, yeah, Ernest? That's right. They saw from a distance with their natural eyes, and there was fear. They didn't trust that it could happen. And, so it's a picture of the gospel that people with their natural eyes, as it were, they see heaven. They aspire to heaven. And they hope that they might end up there. They dream that they would be there. And yet, the reality is, to get there, you've got to dispossess the land. Because the land is held by sin and death. They're big giants. And none of us are able to defeat sin. None of us is able to defeat death. Christ has come to go before us, and he has dispossessed the land. He's defeated sin and death. And when we put our trust in him, we get to go in and partake, to lay hold of that promised land. Because we were like the rebels who at Kadesh Barnea said it wasn't possible. And so we deserve to perish in the wilderness because we don't want to go into the promised land because we're afraid of it. Sin and death is there. We don't want to go back to Egypt because we're slaves there. We're stuck in the wilderness. And it's a miserable existence. It's a hellish existence. And so it falls on us to perish in the wilderness then. But Christ came and took our place, and he perished on our behalf. And as soon as he perished, the way was open for us to step in and take possession of the land. Because God goes before us. And so the possession of the land becomes easy because we take it by grace through faith. And so those that were saved back in the possession of the land, as it were, those who were saved through the wilderness, are the ones who had faith in Christ. They put their trust in God to deliver them through death, and so that they could take hold of the possession that was theirs.